a user to plug expansion cards into a computer's motherboard and thus add some new functionality. Wozniak won that argument. The Apple II had 8 slots. But this time around, it would be Jobs' machine, not Wozniak's, and the Macintosh would have limited slots. You wouldn't even be able to open the case and get to the motherboard. For a hobbyist or hacker, that was uncool. But for Jobs, the Macintosh was for the masses. He wanted to give them a controlled experience. It reflects his personality, which is to want control, said Barry Cash, who was hired by Jobs in 1982 to be a market strategist at Texaco Towers. Steve would talk about the Apple II and complain, "We don't have control, and look at all these crazy things people are trying to do to it. That's a mistake I'll never make again." He went so far as to design special tools so that the Macintosh case could not be opened with a regular screwdriver. "We're going to design this thing so nobody but Apple employees can get inside this box," he told Cash. Jobs also decided to eliminate the cursor arrow keys on the Macintosh keyboard. The only way to move the cursor was to use the mouse. It was a way of forcing old-fashioned users to adapt to point-and-click navigation, even if they didn't want to. Unlike other product developers, Jobs did not believe the customer was always right. If they wanted to resist using a mouse, they were wrong. There was one other advantage, he believed, to eliminating the cursor keys. It forced outside software developers to write programs specially for the Mac operating system, rather than merely writing generic software that could be ported to a variety of computers. That made for the type of tight vertical integration between application software, operating systems, and hardware devices that Jobs liked. Jobs' desire for end-to-end control also made him allergic to proposals that Apple licensed the Macintosh operating system to other office equipment manufacturers and allow them to make Macintosh clones. The new and energetic Macintosh marketing director, Mike Murray, proposed a licensing program in a confidential memo to Jobs in May 1982. "We would like the Macintosh user environment to become an industry standard," he wrote. The hitch, of course, is that now one must buy Mac hardware in order to get this user environment. Rarely, if ever, has one company been able to create and maintain an industry-wide standard that cannot be shared with other manufacturers. His proposal was to license the Macintosh operating system to Tandy. Because Tandy's Radio Shack stores went after a different type of customer, Murray argued, it would not severely cannibalize Apple sales. But Jobs was congenitally averse to such a plan. His approach meant that the Macintosh remained a controlled environment that met his standards, but it also meant that, as Murray feared, it would have trouble securing its place as an industry standard in a world of IBM clones. Machines of the Year. As 1982 drew to a close, Jobs came to believe that he was going to be Times' Man of the Year. He arrived at Texaco Towers one day with the magazine's San Francisco bureau chief, Michael Moritz, and encouraged colleagues to give Moritz interviews. But Jobs did not end up on the cover. Instead, the magazine chose the computer as the topic for the year-end issue and called it the Machine of the Year. Accompanying the main story was a profile of Jobs, which was based on the reporting done by Moritz and written by Jay Cox, an editor who usually handled rock music for the magazine. With his smooth sales pitch and a blind faith that would have been the envy of early Christian martyrs, it is Stephen Jobs, more than anyone, who kicked open the door and let the personal computer move in, the story proclaimed. It was a richly reported piece, but also harsh at times. So harsh that Moritz, after he wrote a book about Apple and went on to be a partner in the venture firm Sequoia Capital with Don Valentine, repudiated it by complaining that his reporting had been siphoned, filtered, and poisoned with gossipy benzene by an editor in New York whose regular task was to chronicle the wayward world of rock and roll music. The article quoted Bud Tribble on Jobs' reality distortion field and noted that he would occasionally burst into tears at meetings. Perhaps the best quote came from Jeff Raskin. Jobs, he declared, would have made an excellent King of France. To Jobs' dismay, the magazine made public the existence of the daughter he had forsaken, Lisa Brennan. He knew that Kottke had been the one to tell the magazine about Lisa, and he berated him in the Mac Group workspace in front of a half dozen people. When the Time reporter asked me if Steve had a daughter named Lisa, I said, "Of course," Kottke recalled. "Friends don't let friends deny that they're the father of a child. I'm not going to let my friend be a jerk and deny paternity." He was really angry and felt violated and told me in front of everyone that I had betrayed him. But what truly devastated Jobs was that he was not, after all, chosen as the Man of the Year. As he later told me, "Time decided they were going to make me Man of the Year, and I was 27, so I actually cared about stuff like that. I thought it was pretty cool. They sent out Mike Moritz to write a story. We're the same age, and I had been very successful, and I could tell he was jealous, and there was an edge to him. He wrote this terrible hatchet job. So the editors in New York get this story and say, 'We can't make this guy Man of the Year.' That really hurt, but it was a good lesson. It taught me to never get too excited about things like that, since the media is a circus anyway. They FedExed me the magazine, and I remember opening the package, thoroughly expecting to see my mug on the cover, and it was this computer sculpture thing. I thought, 'Huh?' And then I read the article, and it was so awful that I actually cried." In fact, there's no reason to believe that Moritz was jealous, or that he intended his reporting to be unfair. Nor was Jobs ever slated to be Man of the Year, despite what he thought. That year, the top editors, I was then a junior editor there, decided early on to go with the computer rather than a person, and they commissioned, months in advance, a piece of art from the famous sculptor George Siegel to be a gatefold cover image. Ray Cave was then the magazine's editor. "We never considered Jobs," he said. "You couldn't personify the computer, so that was the first time we decided to go with an inanimate object. We never searched around for a face to be put on the cover." Apple launched the Lisa in January 1983, a full year before the Mac was ready, and Jobs paid his $5,000 wager to Couch. Even though he was not part of the Lisa team, Jobs went to New York to do publicity for it in his role as Apple's chairman and poster boy. He had learned from his public relations consultant, Regis McKenna, how to dole out exclusive interviews in a dramatic manner. Reporters from anointed publications were ushered in sequentially for their hour with him in his Carlisle Hotel suite, where a Lisa computer was set on a table and surrounded by cut flowers. The publicity plan called for Jobs to focus on the Lisa and not mention the Macintosh, because speculation about it could undermine the Lisa. But Jobs couldn't help himself. In most of the stories based on his interviews that day, in Time, Business Week, The Wall Street Journal, and Fortune, the Macintosh was mentioned. Later this year, Apple will introduce a less powerful, less expensive version of Lisa, the Macintosh, Fortune reported. Jobs himself has directed that project. Business Week quoted him as saying, "When it comes out, Mac is going to be the most incredible computer in the world." He also admitted that the Mac and the Lisa would not be compatible. It was like launching the Lisa with the kiss of death. The Lisa did indeed die a slow death. Within 2 years, it would be discontinued. It was too expensive, and we were trying to sell it to big companies when our expertise was selling to consumers, Jobs later said. But there was a silver lining for Jobs. Within months of Lisa's launch, it became clear that Apple had to pin its hopes on the Macintosh instead. Let's be pirates. As the Macintosh team grew, it moved from Texaco Towers to the main Apple buildings on Bandley Drive, finally settling in mid-1983 into Bandley 3. It had a modern atrium lobby with video games, which Burl Smith and Andy Hertzfeld chose, and a Toshiba compact disc stereo system with Martin Logan speakers and 100 CDs. The software team was visible from the lobby in a fishbowl-like glass enclosure, and the kitchen was stocked daily with Odwalla juices. Over time, the atrium attracted even more toys, most notably a Bösendorfer piano and a BMW motorcycle that Jobs felt would inspire an obsession with lapidary craftsmanship. Jobs kept a tight rein on the hiring process. The goal was to get people who were creative, wickedly smart, and slightly rebellious. The software team would make applicants play Defender, Smith's favorite video game. Jobs would ask his usual offbeat questions to see how well the applicant could think in unexpected situations. One day, he, Hertzfeld, and Smith interviewed a candidate for software manager who, it became clear as soon as he walked in the room, was too uptight and conventional to manage the wizards in the fishbowl. Jobs began to toy with him mercilessly. "How old were you when you lost your virginity?" he asked. The candidate looked baffled. "What did you say?" "Are you a virgin?" Jobs asked. The candidate sat there flustered, so Jobs changed the subject. "How many times have you taken LSD?" Hertzfeld recalled, "The poor guy was turning varying shades of red, so I tried to change the subject and asked a straightforward technical question." But when the candidate droned on in his response, Jobs broke in. "Gobble, gobble, gobble, gobble," he said, cracking up Smith and Hertzfeld. "I guess I'm not the right guy," the poor man said as he got up to leave. For all of his obnoxious behavior, Jobs also had the ability to instill in his team an esprit de corps. After tearing people down, he would find ways to lift them up and make them feel that being part of the Macintosh project was an amazing mission. Every 6 months, he would take most of his team on a 2-day retreat at a nearby resort. The retreat in September 1982 was at the Pajaro Dunes near Monterey. 50 or so members of the Mac division sat in the lodge facing a fireplace. Jobs sat on top of a table in front of them. He spoke quietly for a while, then walked to an easel and began posting his thoughts. The first was "Don't compromise." It was an injunction that would over time be both helpful and harmful. Most technology teams made trade-offs. The Mac, on the other hand, would end up being as insanely great as Jobs and his acolytes could possibly make it, but it would not ship for another 16 months, way behind schedule. After mentioning a scheduled completion date, he told them it would be better to miss than to turn out the wrong thing. A different type of project manager, willing to make some trade-offs, might try to lock in dates after which no changes could be made. Not Jobs. He displayed another maxim. It's not done until it ships. Another chart contained a Cohen-like phrase that he later told me was his favorite maxim. The journey is the reward. The Mac team, he liked to emphasize, was a special corps with an exalted mission. Someday they would all look back on their journey together and, forgetting or laughing off the painful moments, would regard it as a magical high point in their lives. At the end of the presentation, someone asked whether he thought they should do some market research to see what customers wanted. "No," he replied, "because customers don't know what they want until we've shown them." Then he pulled out a device that was about the size of a desk diary. "Do you want to see something neat?" When he flipped it open, it turned out to be a mock-up of a computer that could fit on your lap, with a keyboard and screen hinged together like a notebook. "This is my dream of what we will be making in the mid to late 80s, he said. They were building a company that would invent the future. For the next 2 days, there were presentations by various team leaders and the influential computer industry analyst Ben Rosen, with a lot of time in the evenings for pool parties and dancing. At the end, Jobs stood in front of the assemblage and gave a soliloquy. "As every day passes, the work 50 people are doing here is going to send a giant ripple through the universe," he said. "I know I might be a little hard to get along with, but this is the most fun thing I've done in my life." Years later, most of those in the audience would be able to laugh about the "little hard to get along with" episodes and agree with him that creating that giant ripple was the most fun they had in their lives. The next retreat was at the end of January 1983, the same month the LISA launched, and there was a shift in tone. 4 months earlier, Jobs had written on his flip chart, "Don't compromise." This time, one of the maxims was, "Real artists ship." Nerves were frayed. Atkinson had been left out of the publicity interviews for the LISA launch, and he marched into Jobs' hotel room and threatened to quit. Jobs tried to minimize the slight, but Atkinson refused to be mollified. Jobs got annoyed. "I don't have time to deal with this now," he said. "I have 60 other people out there who are pouring their hearts into the Macintosh, and they're waiting for me to start the meeting." With that, he brushed past Atkinson to go address the faithful. Jobs proceeded to give a rousing speech in which he claimed that he had resolved the dispute with Macintosh Audio Labs to use the Macintosh name. In fact, the issue was still being negotiated, but the moment called for a bit of the old reality distortion field. He pulled out a bottle of mineral water and symbolically christened the prototype on stage. Down the hall, Atkinson heard the loud cheer and with a sigh joined the group. The ensuing party featured skinny dipping in the pool, a bonfire on the beach, and loud music that lasted all night, which caused the hotel, La Playa in Carmel, to ask them never to come back. Another of Jobs's maxims at the retreat was, "It's better to be a pirate than to join the Navy." He wanted to instill a rebel spirit in his team, to have them behave like swashbucklers who were proud of their work but willing to commandeer from others. As Susan Kerr put it, he meant, "Let's have a renegade feeling to our group. We can move fast. We can get things done." To celebrate Jobs' birthday a few weeks later, the team paid for a billboard on the road to Apple headquarters. It read, "Happy 28th, Steve. The journey is the reward. The Pirates." One of the Mac team's programmers, Steve Capps, decided this new spirit warranted hoisting a Jolly Roger. He cut a patch of black cloth and had Care paint a skull and crossbones on it. The eye patch she put on the skull was an Apple logo. Late one Sunday night, Capps climbed to the roof of their newly built Bandley 3 building and hoisted the flag on a scaffolding pole that the construction workers had left behind. It waved proudly for a few weeks, until members of the LISA team, in a late-night foray, stole the flag and sent their Mac rivals a ransom note. Capps led a raid to recover it and was about to wrestle it from a secretary who was guarding it for the LISA team. Some of the grown-ups overseeing Apple worried that Jobs' buccaneer spirit was getting out of hand. "Flying that flag was really stupid," said Arthur Rock. "It was telling the rest of the company they were no good." But Jobs loved it, and he made sure it waved proudly all the way through to the completion of the Mac project. "We were the renegades, and we wanted people to know it," he recalled. Veterans of the Mac team had learned that they could stand up to Jobs. If they knew what they were talking about, he would tolerate the pushback, even admire it. By 1983, those most familiar with his reality distortion field had discovered something further. They could, if necessary, just quietly disregard what he decreed. If they turned out to be right, he would appreciate their renegade attitude and willingness to ignore authority. After all, that's what he did. By far the most important example of this involved the choice of a disk drive for the Macintosh. Apple had a corporate division that built mass storage devices, and it had developed a disk drive system, codenamed Twiggy, that could read and write onto those thin, delicate 5 1/4 inch floppy disks that older readers, who also remember Twiggy the model, will recall. But by the time the Lisa was ready to ship in the spring of 1983, it was clear that the Twiggy was buggy. Because the Lisa also came with a hard disk drive, this was not a complete disaster, but the Mac had no hard disk, so it faced a crisis. "The Mac team was beginning to panic," said Hertzfeld. "We were using a single Twiggy drive, and we didn't have a hard disk to fall back on." The team discussed the problem at the January 1983 retreat, and Debbie Coleman gave Jobs data about the Twiggy failure rate. A few days later, he drove to Apple's factory in San Jose to see the Twiggy being made. More than half were rejected. Jobs erupted. With his face flushed, he began shouting and sputtering about firing everyone who worked there. Bob Belleville, the head of the Mac engineering team, gently guided him to the parking lot where they could take a walk and talk about alternatives. One possibility that Belleville had been exploring was to use a new 3 1/2 inch disk drive that Sony had developed. The disk was cased in sturdier plastic and could fit into a shirt pocket. Another option was to have a clone of Sony's 3 1/2 inch disk drive manufactured by a smaller Japanese supplier, the Alps Electronics Company, which had been supplying disk drives for the Apple II. Alps had already licensed the technology from Sony, and if they could build their own version in time, it would be much cheaper. Jobs and Belleville, along with Apple veteran Rod Holt, the guy Jobs enlisted to design the first power supply for the Apple II, flew to Japan to figure out what to do. They took the bullet train from Tokyo to visit the Alps facility. The engineers there didn't even have a working prototype, just a crude model. Jobs thought it was great, but Belleville was appalled. There was no way, he thought, that Alps could have it ready for the Mac within a year. As they proceeded to visit other Japanese companies, Jobs was on his worst behavior. He wore jeans and sneakers to meetings with Japanese managers in dark suits. When they formally handed him little gifts, as was the custom, he often left them behind, and he never reciprocated with gifts of his own. He would sneer when rows of engineers lined up to greet him, bow, and politely offer their products for inspection. Jobs hated both the devices and the obsequiousness. "What are you showing me this for?" he snapped at one stop. "This is a piece of crap. Anybody could build a better drive than this." Although most of his hosts were appalled, some seemed amused. They had heard tales of his obnoxious style and brash behavior, and now they were getting to see it in full display. The final stop was the Sony factory, located in a drab suburb of Tokyo. To Jobs, it looked messy and inelegant. A lot of the work was done by hand. He hated it. Back at the hotel, Belleville argued for going with the Sony disk drive. It was ready to use. Jobs disagreed. He decided that they would work with Alps to produce their own drive, and he ordered Belleville to cease all work with Sony. Belleville decided it was best to partially ignore Jobs, and he asked a Sony executive to get its disk drive ready for use in the Macintosh. If and when it became clear that Alps could not deliver on time, Apple would switch to Sony. So Sony sent over the engineer who had developed the drive, Hidetoshi Komoto, a Purdue graduate who fortunately possessed a good sense of humor about his clandestine task. Whenever Jobs would come from his corporate office to visit the Mac team's engineers, which was almost every afternoon, they would hurriedly find somewhere for Komoto to hide. At one point, Jobs ran into him at a newsstand in Cupertino and recognized him from the meeting in Japan, but he didn't suspect anything. The closest call was when Jobs came bustling onto the Mac workspace unexpectedly one day, while Komoto was sitting in one of the cubicles. A Mac engineer grabbed him and pointed him to the janitorial closet. "Quick! Hide in this closet! Please! Now!" Komoto looked confused, Hertzfeld recalled, but he jumped up and did as told. He had to stay in the closet for 5 minutes until Jobs left. The Mac engineers apologized. "No problem," he replied, "but American business practices, they are very strange, very strange." Belleville's prediction came true. In May 1983, the folks at Alps admitted it would take them at least 18 more months to get their clone of the Sony drive into production. At a retreat in Pajaro Dunes, Markkula grilled Jobs on what he was going to do. Finally, Belleville interrupted and said that he might have an alternative to the Alps drive ready soon. Jobs looked baffled for just a moment, and then it became clear to him why he'd glimpsed Sony's top disc designer in Cupertino. "You son of a bitch," Jobs said. But it was not in anger. There was a big grin on his face. As soon as he realized what Belleville and the other engineers had done behind his back, said Hertzfeld, Steve swallowed his pride and thanked them for disobeying him and doing the right thing. It was, after all, what he would have done in their situation. Chapter 14. Enter Scully. The Pepsi Challenge. The Courtship. Mike Markkula had never wanted to be Apple's president. He liked designing his new houses, flying his private plane, and living high off his stock options. He did not relish adjudicating conflict or curating high-maintenance egos. He had stepped into the role reluctantly, after he felt compelled to ease out Mike Scott, and he promised his wife the gig would be temporary. By the end of 1982, after almost 2 years, she gave him an order: find a replacement right away. Jobs knew that he was not ready to run the company himself, even though there was a part of him that wanted to try. Despite his arrogance, he could be self-aware. Markkula agreed. He told Jobs that he was still a bit too rough-edged and immature to be Apple's president. So they launched a search for someone from the outside. The person they most wanted was Don Estridge, who had built IBM's personal computer division from scratch and launched a PC that, even though Jobs and his team disparaged it, was now outselling Apple's. Estridge had sheltered his division in Boca Raton, Florida, safely removed from the corporate mentality of Armonk, New York. Like Jobs, he was driven and inspiring, but unlike Jobs, he had the ability to allow others to think that his brilliant ideas were their own. Jobs flew to Boca Raton with the offer of a $1 million salary and a $1 million signing bonus, but Estridge turned him down. He was not the type who would jump ship to join the enemy. He also enjoyed being part of the establishment, a member of the Navy rather than a pirate. He was discomforted by Jobs's tales of ripping off the phone company. When asked where he worked, he loved to be able to answer, IBM. So Jobs and Markkula enlisted Jerry Roche, a gregarious corporate headhunter, to find someone else. They decided not to focus on technology executives. What they needed was a consumer marketer who knew advertising and had the corporate polish that would play well on Wall Street. Roche set his sights on the hottest consumer marketing wizard of the moment, John Scully, president of the Pepsi-Cola division of PepsiCo, whose Pepsi Challenge campaign had been an advertising and publicity triumph. When Jobs gave a talk to Stanford business students, he heard good things about Scully, who had spoken to the class earlier, so he told Roche he would be happy to meet him. Scully's background was very different from Jobs's. His mother was an Upper East Side Manhattan matron who wore white gloves when she went out, and his father was a proper Wall Street lawyer. Scully was sent off to St. Mark's School, then got his undergraduate degree from Brown and a business degree from Wharton. He had risen through the ranks at PepsiCo as an innovative marketer and advertiser with little passion for product development or information technology. Scully flew to Los Angeles to spend Christmas with his two teenage children from a previous marriage. He took them to visit a computer store where he was struck by how poorly the products were marketed. When his kids asked why he was so interested, he said he was planning to go up to Cupertino to meet Steve Jobs. They were totally blown away. They had grown up among movie stars, but to them, Jobs was a true celebrity. It made Scully take more seriously the prospect of being hired as his boss. When he arrived at Apple headquarters, Scully was startled by the unassuming offices and casual atmosphere. Most people were less formally dressed than PepsiCo's maintenance staff, he noted. Over lunch, Jobs picked quietly at his salad, but when Scully declared that most executives found computers more trouble than they were worth, Jobs clicked into evangelical mode. "We want to change the way people use computers," he said. On the flight home, Scully outlined his thoughts. The result was an 8-page memo on marketing computers to consumers and business executives. It was a bit sophomoric in parts, filled with underlined phrases, diagrams, and boxes, but it revealed his newfound enthusiasm for figuring out ways to sell something more interesting than soda. Among his recommendations, invest in in-store merchandising that romances the consumer with Apple's potential to enrich their life. He was still reluctant to leave Pepsi, but Jobs intrigued him. "I was taken by this young, impetuous genius and thought it would be fun to get to know him a little better," he recalled. So Scully agreed to meet again when Jobs next came to New York, which happened to be for the January 1983 Lisa introduction at the Carlyle Hotel. After the full day of press sessions, the Apple team was surprised to see an unscheduled visitor come into the suite. Jobs loosened his tie and introduced Scully as the president of Pepsi and a potential big corporate customer. As John Couch demonstrated the Lisa, Jobs chimed in with bursts of commentary, sprinkled with his favorite words, revolutionary and incredible, claiming it would change the nature of human interaction with computers. They then headed off to the Four Seasons restaurant, a shimmering haven of elegance and power. As Jobs ate a special vegan meal, Scully described Pepsi's marketing successes. "The Pepsi Generation campaign," he said, "sold not a product, but a lifestyle and an optimistic outlook. I think Apple's got a chance to create an Apple generation." Jobs enthusiastically agreed. The Pepsi Challenge campaign, in contrast, focused on the product. It combined ads, events, and public relations to stir up buzz. The ability to turn the introduction of a new product into a moment of national excitement was, Jobs noted, what he and Regis McKenna wanted to do at Apple. When they finished talking, it was close to midnight. "This has been one of the most exciting evenings in my whole life," Jobs said as Scully walked him back to the Carlyle. "I can't tell you how much fun I've had." When he finally got home to Greenwich, Connecticut that night, Scully had trouble sleeping. Engaging with Jobs was a lot more fun than negotiating with bottlers. "It stimulated me, roused my long-held desire to be an architect of ideas," he later noted. The next morning, Roche called Scully. "I don't know what you guys did last night, but let me tell you, Steve Jobs is ecstatic," he said. And so the courtship continued, with Scully playing hard but not impossible to get. Jobs flew east for a visit one Saturday in February and took a limo up to Greenwich. He found Scully's newly built mansion ostentatious, with its floor-to-ceiling windows, but he admired the 300-pound custom-made oak doors that were so carefully hung and balanced that they swung open with the touch of a finger. Steve was fascinated by that because he is, as I am, a perfectionist, Scully recalled. Thus began the somewhat unhealthy process of a star-struck Scully perceiving in Jobs qualities that he fancied in himself. Scully usually drove a Cadillac, but sensing his guest's taste, he borrowed his wife's Mercedes 450 SL convertible to take Jobs to see Pepsi's 144-acre corporate headquarters, which was as lavish as Apple's was austere. To Jobs, it epitomized the difference between the feisty new digital economy and the Fortune 500 corporate establishment. A winding drive led through manicured fields and a sculpture garden, including pieces by Rodin, Moore, Calder, and Giacometti, to a concrete and glass building designed by Edward Durell Stone. Scully's huge office had a Persian rug, 9 windows, a small private garden, a hideaway study, and its own bathroom. When Jobs saw the corporate fitness center, he was astonished that executives had an area with its own whirlpool separate from that of the regular employees. "That's weird," he said. Scully hastened to agree. "As a matter of fact, I was against it, and I go over and work out sometimes in the employees' area," he said. The next meeting was a few weeks later in Cupertino, when Scully stopped on his way back from a Pepsi bottlers convention in Hawaii. Mike Murray, the Macintosh marketing manager, took charge of preparing the team for the visit, but he was not clued in on the real agenda. PepsiCo could end up purchasing literally thousands of Macs over the next few years, he exulted in a memo to the Macintosh staff. During the past year, Mr. Scully and a certain Mr. Jobs have become friends. Mr. Scully is considered to be one of the best marketing heads in the big leagues. As such, let's give him a good time here. Jobs wanted Scully to share his excitement about the Macintosh. "This product means more to me than anything I've done," he said. "I want you to be the first person outside of Apple to see it." He dramatically pulled the prototype out of a vinyl bag and gave a demonstration. Scully found Jobs as memorable as his machine. He seemed more a showman than a businessman. Every move seemed calculated, as if it was rehearsed to create an occasion of the moment. Jobs had asked Hertzfeld and the gang to prepare a special screen display for Scully's amusement. "He's really smart," Jobs said. "You wouldn't believe how smart he is." The explanation that Scully might buy a lot of Macintoshes for Pepsi sounded a little bit fishy to me, Hertzfeld recalled. But he and Susan Kerr created a screen of Pepsi caps and cans that danced around with the Apple logo. Hertzfeld was so excited he began waving his arms around during the demo, but Scully seemed underwhelmed. He asked a few questions, but he didn't seem all that interested, Hertzfeld recalled. He never ended up warming to Scully. "He was incredibly phony, a complete poseur," he later said. He pretended to be interested in technology, but he wasn't. He was a marketing guy, and that is what marketing guys are, paid poseurs. Matters came to a head when Jobs visited New York in March 1983 and was able to convert the courtship into a blind and blinding romance. "I really think you're the guy," Jobs said as they walked through Central Park. "I want you to come and work with me. I can learn so much from you." Jobs, who had cultivated father figures in the past, knew just how to play to Scully's ego and insecurities. It worked. "I was smitten by him," Scully later admitted. "Steve was one of the brightest people I had ever met. I shared with him a passion for ideas." Scully, who was interested in art history, steered them toward the Metropolitan Museum for a little test of whether Jobs was really willing to learn from others. "I wanted to see how well he could take coaching in a subject where he had no background," he recalled. As they strolled through the Greek and Roman antiquities, Scully expounded on the difference between the archaic sculpture of the 6th century BC and the Periclean sculptures a century later. Jobs, who loved to pick up historical nuggets he never learned in college, seemed to soak it in. I gained a sense that I could be a teacher to a brilliant student, Scully recalled. Once again, he indulged the conceit that they were alike. I saw in him a mirror image of my younger self. I, too, was impatient, stubborn, arrogant, impetuous. My mind exploded with ideas, often to the exclusion of everything else. I, too, was intolerant of those who couldn't live up to my demands. As they continued their long walk, Scully confided that on vacations he went to the Left Bank in Paris to draw in his sketchbook. If he hadn't become a businessman, he would be an artist. Jobs replied that if he weren't working with computers, he could see himself as a poet in Paris. They continued down Broadway to Colony Records on 49th Street, where Jobs showed Scully the music he liked, including Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, Ella Fitzgerald, and the Windham Hill jazz artists. Then they walked all the way back up to the San Remo on Central Park West and 74th, where Jobs was planning to buy a two-story tower penthouse apartment. The consummation occurred outside the penthouse on one of the terraces, with Scully sticking close to the wall because he was afraid of heights. First, they discussed money. I told him I needed $1 million in salary, $1 million for a sign-up bonus, said Scully. Jobs claimed that would be doable, even if I have to pay for it out of my own pocket, he said. We'll have to solve those problems, because you're the best person I've ever met. I know you're perfect for Apple, and Apple deserves the best. He added that never before had he worked for someone he really respected, but he knew that Scully was the person who could teach him the most. Jobs gave him his unblinking stare. Scully uttered one last demurral, a token suggestion that maybe they should just be friends, and he could offer Jobs advice from the sidelines. Anytime you're in New York, I'd love to spend time with you. He later recounted the climactic moment. Steve's head dropped as he stared at his feet. After a weighty, uncomfortable pause, he issued a challenge that would haunt me for days. Do you want to spend the rest of your life selling sugared water, or do you want a chance to change the world? Scully felt as if he had been punched in the stomach. There was no response possible other than to acquiesce. He had an uncanny ability to always get what he wanted, to size up a person and know exactly what to say to reach a person, Scully recalled. I realized for the first time in 4 months that I couldn't say no. The winter sun was beginning to set. They left the apartment and walked back across the park to the Carlisle. The Honeymoon. Scully arrived in California just in time for the May 1983 Apple Management Retreat at Pajaro Dunes. Even though he had left all but one of his dark suits back in Greenwich, he was still having trouble adjusting to the casual atmosphere. In the front of the meeting room, Jobs sat on the floor in the lotus position, absent-mindedly playing with the toes of his bare feet. Scully tried to impose an agenda. He wanted to discuss how to differentiate their products, the Apple II, Apple III, Lisa, and Mac, and whether it made sense to organize the company around product lines or markets or functions. But the discussion descended into a free-for-all of random ideas, complaints, and debates. At one point, Jobs attacked the Lisa team for producing an unsuccessful product. Well, someone shot back, you haven't delivered the Macintosh. Why don't you wait until you get a product out before you start being critical? Scully was astonished. At Pepsi, no one would have challenged the chairman like that. Yet here, everyone began pigpiling on Steve. It reminded him of an old joke he had heard from one of the Apple ad salesmen. What's the difference between Apple and the Boy Scouts? The Boy Scouts have adult supervision. In the midst of the bickering, a small earthquake began to rumble the room. Head for the beach, someone shouted. Everyone ran through the door to the water. Then someone else shouted that the previous earthquake had produced a tidal wave, so they all turned and ran the other way. The indecision, the contradictory advice, the specter of natural disaster only foreshadowed what was to come, Scully later wrote. One Saturday morning, Jobs invited Scully and his wife, Leezy, over for breakfast. He was then living in a nice but unexceptional Tudor-style home in Los Gatos with his girlfriend, Barbara Jasinski, a smart and reserved beauty who worked for Regis McKenna. Leezy had brought a pan and made vegetarian omelets. Jobs had edged away from his strict vegan diet for the time being. "I'm sorry I don't have much furniture," Jobs apologized. "I just haven't gotten around to it." It was one of his enduring quirks, his exacting standards of craftsmanship combined with a Spartan streak, made him reluctant to buy any furnishings that he wasn't passionate about. He had a Tiffany lamp, an antique dining table, and a laser disc video attached to a Sony Trinitron, but foam cushions on the floor rather than sofas and chairs. Scully smiled and mistakenly thought that it was similar to his own frantic and Spartan life in a cluttered New York City apartment early in his own career. Jobs confided in Scully that he believed he would die young, and therefore he needed to accomplish things quickly so that he would make his mark on Silicon Valley history. "We all have a short period of time on this earth," he told the Scullies as they sat around the table that morning. "We probably only have the opportunity to do a few things really great, and do them well. None of us has any idea how long we're going to be here, nor do I, but my feeling is I've got to accomplish a lot of these things while I'm young." Jobs and Scully would talk dozens of times a day in the early months of their relationship. "Steve and I became soulmates, near constant companions," Scully said. "We tended to speak in half sentences and phrases." Jobs flattered Scully. When he dropped by to hash something out, he would say something like, "You're the only one who will understand." They would tell each other repeatedly, indeed so often that it should have been worrying, how happy they were to be with each other and working in tandem. And at every opportunity, Scully would find similarities with Jobs and point them out. "We could complete each other's sentences because we were on the same wavelength. Steve would rouse me from sleep at 2 a.m. with a phone call to chat about an idea that suddenly crossed his mind. 'Hi, it's me,' he'd harmlessly say to the dazed listener, totally unaware of the time. I, curiously, had done the same in my Pepsi days. Steve would rip apart a presentation he had to give the next morning, throwing out slides and text. So had I, as I struggled to turn public speaking into an important management tool during my early days at Pepsi. As a young executive, I was always impatient to get things done and often felt I could do them better myself. So did Steve. Sometimes I felt as if I was watching Steve playing me in a movie. The similarities were uncanny, and they were behind the amazing symbiosis we developed." This was self-delusion, and it was a recipe for disaster. Jobs began to sense it early on. "We had different ways of looking at the world, different views on people, different values," Jobs recalled. "I began to realize this a few months after he arrived. He didn't learn things very quickly, and the people he wanted to promote were usually bozos." Yet Jobs knew that he could manipulate Scully by encouraging his belief that they were so alike, and the more he manipulated Scully, the more contemptuous of him he became. Canny observers in the Mac group, such as Joanna Hoffman, soon realized what was happening and knew that it would make the inevitable breakup more explosive. "Steve made Scully feel like he was exceptional," she said. Scully had never felt that. Scully became infatuated because Steve projected on him a whole bunch of attributes that he didn't really have. When it became clear that Scully didn't match all of these projections, Steve's distortion of reality had created an explosive situation. The ardor eventually began to cool on Scully's side as well. Part of his weakness in trying to manage a dysfunctional company was his desire to please other people, one of many traits that he did not share with Jobs. He was a polite person. This caused him to recoil at Jobs's rudeness to their fellow workers. "We would go to the Mac building at 11 at night," he recalled, "and they would bring him code to show. In some cases, he wouldn't even look at it. He would just take it and throw it back at them. I'd say, 'How can you turn it down?' And he would say, 'I know they can do better.'" Scully tried to coach him. "You've got to learn to hold things back," he told him at one point. Jobs would agree, but it was not in his nature to filter his feelings through a gauze. Scully began to believe that Jobs's mercurial personality and erratic treatment of people were rooted deep in his psychological makeup, perhaps the reflection of a mild bipolarity. There were big mood swings. Sometimes he would be ecstatic, and other times he was depressed. At times he would launch into brutal tirades without warning, and Scully would have to calm him down. 20 minutes later, I would get another call and be told to come over because Steve is losing it again," he said. Their first substantive disagreement was over how to price the Macintosh. It had been conceived as a $1,000 machine, but Jobs's design changes had pushed up the cost so that the plan was to sell it at $1,995. However, when Jobs and Scully began making plans for a huge launch and marketing push, Scully decided that they needed to charge $500 more. To him, the marketing costs were like any other production cost and needed to be factored into the price. Jobs resisted furiously. "It will destroy everything we stand for," he said. "I want to make this a revolution, not an effort to squeeze out profits." Scully said it was a simple choice. He could have the $1,995 price, or he could have the marketing budget for a big launch, but not both. "You're not going to like this," Jobs told Hertzfeld and the other engineers, "but Scully is insisting that we charge $2,495 for the Mac instead of $1,995. Indeed, the engineers were horrified. Hertzfeld pointed out that they were designing the Mac for people like themselves, and overpricing it would be a betrayal of what they stood for. So Jobs promised them, "Don't worry, I'm not going to let him get away with it." But in the end, Scully prevailed. Even 25 years later, Jobs seethed when recalling the decision. "It's the main reason the Macintosh sales slowed and Microsoft got to dominate the market." The decision made him feel that he was losing control of his product and company, and that was as dangerous as making a tiger feel cornered. Chapter 15. The Launch. A Dent in the Universe. Real Artists Ship. The high point of the October 1983 Apple sales conference in Hawaii was a skit based on a TV show called The Dating Game. Jobs played MC, and his three contestants, whom he had convinced to fly to Hawaii, were Bill Gates and two other software executives, Mitch Kapoor and Fred Gibbons. As the show's jingly theme song played, the three took their stools. Gates, looking like a high school sophomore, got wild applause from the 750 Apple salesmen when he said, "During 1984, Microsoft expects to get half of its revenues from software for the Macintosh." Jobs, clean-shaven and bouncy, gave a toothy smile and asked if he thought that the Macintosh's new operating system would become one of the industry's new standards. Gates answered, "To create a new standard takes not just making something that's a little bit different, it takes something that's really new and captures people's imagination. And the Macintosh, of all the machines I've ever seen, is the only one that meets that standard." But even as Gates was speaking, Microsoft was edging away from being primarily a collaborator with Apple to being more of a competitor. It would continue to make application software, like Microsoft Word for Apple, but a rapidly increasing share of its revenue would come from the operating system it had written for the IBM personal computer. The year before, 279,000 Apple IIs were sold compared to 240,000 IBM PCs and its clones. But the figures for 1983 were coming in starkly different. 420,000 Apple IIs versus 1.3 million IBMs and its clones. And both the Apple III and the Lisa were dead in the water. Just when the Apple sales force was arriving in Hawaii, this shift was hammered home on the cover of Business Week. Its headline, Personal Computers, and the winner is IBM. The story inside detailed the rise of the IBM PC. The battle for market supremacy is already over, the magazine declared. In a stunning blitz, IBM has taken more than 26% of the market in 2 years and is expected to account for half the world market by 1985. An additional 25% of the market will be turning out IBM-compatible machines. That put all the more pressure on the Macintosh, due out in January 1984, 3 months away, to save the day against IBM. At the sales conference, Jobs decided to play the showdown to the hilt. He took the stage and chronicled all the missteps made by IBM since 1958, and then in ominous tones described how it was now trying to take over the market for personal computers. Will Big Blue dominate the entire computer industry? The entire information age? Was George Orwell right about 1984? At that moment, a screen came down from the ceiling and showed a preview of an upcoming 60-second television ad for the Macintosh. In a few months, it was destined to make advertising history. But in the meantime, it served its purpose of rallying Apple's demoralized sales force. Jobs had always been able to draw energy by imagining himself as a rebel pitted against the forces of darkness. Now he was able to energize his troops with the same vision. There was one more hurdle. Hertzfeld and the other wizards had to finish writing the code for the Macintosh. It was due to start shipping on Monday, January 16th. 1 week before that, the engineers concluded they could not make that deadline. Jobs was at the Grand Hyatt in Manhattan, preparing for the press previews, so a Sunday morning conference call was scheduled. The software manager calmly explained the situation to Jobs, while Hertzfeld and the others huddled around the speakerphone holding their breaths. All they needed was an extra 2 weeks. The initial shipments to the dealers could have a version of the software labeled Demo, and these could be replaced as soon as the new code was finished at the end of the month. There was a pause. Jobs did not get angry. Instead, he spoke in cold, somber tones. He told them they were really great. So great, in fact, that he knew they could get this done. There's no way we're slipping, he declared. There was a collective gasp in the Bandley building workspace. You guys have been working on this stuff for months now. Another couple weeks isn't going to make that much of a difference. You may as well get it over with. I'm going to ship the code a week from Monday with your names on it. Well, we've got to finish it, Steve Capp said. And so they did. Once again, Jobs's reality distortion field pushed them to do what they had thought impossible. On Friday, Randy Wigginton brought in a huge bag of chocolate-covered espresso beans for the final three all-nighters. When Jobs arrived at work at 8:30 a.m. that Monday, he found Hertzfeld sprawled nearly comatose on the couch. They talked for a few minutes about a remaining tiny glitch, and Jobs decreed that it wasn't a problem. Hertzfeld dragged himself to his blue Volkswagen Rabbit, license plate MACWIZ, and drove home to bed. A short while later, Apple's Fremont factory began to roll out boxes emblazoned with the colorful line drawings of the Macintosh. "Real artists ship," Jobs had declared, and now the Macintosh team had. The 1984 ad. In the spring of 1983, when Jobs had begun to plan for the Macintosh launch,